Hi, this is Ari Roth, playwright and artistic director of the new Mosaic Theater Company, and I'm talking with Rabbi Saul Solomon on Dave's Gone By on UNC Radio.
Shalom, shalom, uvracha, everybody. This is Rabbi Saul Solomon, the founder and spiritual leader of Temple Sons of Bitches in Great Neck, New York. And I am delighted and thrilled to be talking to an artiste, someone who is a playwright and a director and even an artistic director, which doesn't mean a director who directs artistically. It means something else. We'll explain. But he has had his plays done at Arena Stage, the American Jewish Theater. He has taught playwriting at the University of Michigan and New York University, which is where the host of this radio program, Dave, went for his degrees, and he's taught at Brandeis. Yay, I love that name. And since 1998, Ari Roth was the artistic director of Theater J in Washington, where they produced more than 100 plays, most of them, almost all of them, on Jewish themes, 35 world premieres. He's not the artistic director anymore. We will explain that as well. But he's got another theater company called The Mosaic. He'll be talking with us about all of that and more. So please welcome a pre-New Year holiday delight to have Ari Roth in the neighborhood. Shalom, Ari.
Shalom, shalom.
How you doing? It must have been a whirlwind month for you. How's it going?
Well, you know, it goes well. I feel like I'm in a drama. I think even our interview, you could consider its own play right now. So I feel like I'm an actor in a very important drama that's playing out, and I feel good about the role that I've been cast in, and I have a strong sense of where I'm heading, and I know what the conflicts are. I know what the complications are. But I see a very good final destination that I'm heading toward.
Final destination is perhaps not a phrase a Jew wants to use, but...
We're all heading to that final destination, Rabbi, as you know. But on our way there, we like to create a little meaning and a little community, so we all have a little company on the journey.
I agree. And in this drama, I consider myself the boy soprano. I think that would be my role in all of this. But let's roll it back for people who aren't necessarily cued in to the whole story of what happened with you and the theater company. Let's build up to it by saying, okay, how did you get into the theater as a kid, as a teenager?
Really, Arthur Miller became a very, very important mentor, model for me. I, of course, read his great play, Death of a Salesman, as a grade schooler, and it affected me more than anything, more than any work I'd ever read, and it made me think, of course, of my own family, my own father.
Was your father a salesman? Is he alive?
My father's a wonderful attorney. He's a
Jewish lawyer!
He's a refugee from Germany, as my mother, who was a hidden child during the Holocaust.
And so, I'll stop you there to ask you, please tell this story. I mean, how did they get the hell out of Germany?
My mother was born in Berlin in 1934, and my father was born in a little farming town outside of Marburg, Germany, in 1929. They were both orphans. My father left after Kristallnacht in 1938. My mother spent the war years on the run with her sister and her mother, going from Berlin to Belgium to northern France to southern France into the Alps in Italy, and finally in a convent in Rome, in the Vatican City, where she was sheltered by nuns. She had a very, very dramatic story, which I've written about as a dramatist, which she's written about. Everybody in my family writes about their experiences and the legacy of the Shoah. My mother went to Palestine on Youth Aliyah, to Ben Shemin Youth Village from 1945 to 47. And my parents met at the University of Chicago in the 1950s, and that's where I was raised. I kind of married my parents' professional disciplines, my mother a psychologist, my father a lawyer. And as I went to Israel, then for a third or a fourth time when I was in college, I discovered creative expression. I wanted to be a songwriter, then I discovered serious poetry. And by the time I came back to University of Michigan for my junior year, and I wanted to continue my free expression as a young man, the only creative writing class that would take me was playwriting. It so happened that playwriting spoke to me. It spoke to the psychological interest in human behavior, and it spoke to the legal form of debate and theater as a kind of form of jurisprudence.
Can I ask you what the first play, what, even if it was in school, the first play that you ever wrote, full-length play?
Sure, I will. I mean, the important thing about University of Michigan is that's where Arthur Miller went to school. And so the first play I ever wrote, which was called The Art of Our Necessities, it was really about my grandmother, who was, of course, the mother courage, the stalwart surviving matriarch who led her children through Europe and with smuggled papers and hiding places and false names and, giving away payments to secure the safety of her children, and eventually arranged for getting the children on a boat to Palestine. I wrote a play about now an aging, elderly grandmother who comes to live in her daughter's house again, and a grandson's relationship with her. For that play, I got my first Avery Hopwood Award from the University of Michigan, and
Mazel.
Coincide with the 50th anniversary of the Creative Writing Prize, and Arthur Miller, a favorite son and alum of University of Michigan who won that same Hopwood Award two times in the 1930s, he came and gave the award. And my father came up from Chicago to see me shake Arthur Miller's hand, and you might say it was then that the die was cast, and I wanted to pursue a career like Arthur Miller had.
Did you ever get to talk with him or just shake his head? Did he ever say anything to you, anything you remember?
I've met him over the years. I liked him a lot. He was, he wouldn't have known me by name, but I knew him. And, I read everything he ever wrote. And I followed his life and his career, and I produced him quite a few times. Well, he just taught me about the playwright's role in society, and the playwriting was a social medium, and it was a way of enlisting the community in really important thought and important conversation, and that's what Miller's plays did in his examples over the decades, stand up for causes and for a sense of decency in our country, and even globally, as a campaigner for human rights, and as somebody who fought as a president of the Penn Faulkner Society for the freedom of artists to express themselves, even in situations where they were under brutal regimes. Arthur Miller fought a great fight, and he wrote great plays, very poetic plays about the family, society, and the individual. So one of the things that was important to me when I became a producer, artistic director of Theater J in 1997, was to honor his living legacy by producing work that he had created as an older artist. While he was still alive, Miller wrote some beautiful one-acts like The Last Yankee, I Can't Remember Anything, The Ryan Interview. We put those all together in an omnibus evening called Danger Memory. That was very fulfilling. It was one of the first productions I ever did at Theater J, along with a play by Miller's real mentor, Clifford Odets. We opened my tenure with Clifford Odets' Waiting for Lefty, and framing around that, interspersed through it, we did scenes from a play we called Still Waiting. So the play Waiting for Lefty, Still Waiting opened the new Theater J season in 1998. Miller followed shortly thereafter in 99, and we kept doing Arthur Miller plays. The Ride Down Mount Morgan, 2001, and then later his great play, The Price.
Oh, well, and that's certainly a very overtly Jewish one, at least for the shop owner.
Yeah, the antique dealer Solomon sounds a little like you, actually.
Little bit. I'm even more miserly, perhaps, than the Eli Wallach character. But I'm getting there. I'm trying. I wish I were the guy in Mount Morgan, stooping to women. That's a lot more fun.
That's why we did that play too, to show the Jews really could have it all. Even though it's very interesting, the character in that play wasn't Jewish, in the same way that Willy Loman wasn't in any overt way a Jewish character, though people over the years and critics, scholars, would argue that Arthur Miller created crypto-Jews, that even if they weren't Jewish in name or by background, that they were familiar to the audience as Jewish figures.
You know, I always felt the same about Tennessee William Stanley Kowalski, but nobody agrees with me on that one. For some strange reason, I don't know. But let me ask you, being a playwright is one thing. You're at the computer, or back then, even the typewriter or the piece of paper. You're writing, you're imagining everything. It is a rather different thing to be a director and an artistic director. How did you make that shift?
Well, it grew organically out of being a playwright who was interested in convening conversations about my work, and it grew out of my teaching, principally for the University of Michigan. Again, I taught in the Arthur Miller tradition. Miller had the same playwriting guru teacher that I had. Kenneth Thorpe Rowe was a guest professor, even when my immediate mentor, Mylon Stitt, taught me. It comes from being an educator and nurturing the development of new plays. And what you do with a student, of course, is you're trying to give birth to the writer within and really help establish a young person, find their voice and find their subject. What you're doing with the more established writer, whether they're in their 20s, 30s, 40s, or in the case of Sir Thomas Keneally or Robert Brustein, you're dealing with playwrights later in their career, but you're still trying to help them hone and shape their play. And I had a great deal of pleasure working on, in fact, 43 world premieres over the 129 productions that I did at Theatre J. My proudest work was as a dramaturg, say a script advisor and consultant, helping to shape so many new works by emerging playwrights and established playwrights alike.
Ari Roth here in the neighborhood talking about how he went into the teaching of theater. He was also writing plays and then becoming a director and a producer. How did you get the gig at Theater J? And explain what Theater J is or was in Washington, D.C.
Well, it still is. I arrived at Theater J's doorstep in 1997 after my wife and I left Ann Arbor, Michigan, where our non-tenure track teaching gigs were running out the string, as it might were. So we, after long and dedicated work at an academic institution, we found ourselves without jobs, looking into a new year, and my wife quickly found a gig at the World Bank in Washington, D.C., and her parents were there, and I dutifully followed with our two kids, and I stumbled into the Washington, D.C. JCC, a place that had actually done a reading of a play of mine, a play called Oh, the Innocents, back in the early 90s, and with their first and founding artistic director, Martin Blank, who was there for 3 years, and then a new artistic director, Randy Hoflick, was there from 94 through 97. But when I arrived in 97, she had taken a maternity leave and had decided not to come back at that point. Theater J itself had been a very small theater company operating in a 35-seat basement boardroom in a townhouse in the DuPont Circle neighborhood of D.C. And now the Washington, D.C. JCC was moving back into its old historic building on 16th and Q, a few blocks over from DuPont Circle, and they had rehabilitated the building and created a gorgeous state-of-the-art 250-seat theater at the center of this building. That was where Theater J, going from the smallest theater in the Washington theater community into now what would be the 10th largest venue in all of Washington, D.C., Music had an initial first season that you might say stumbled badly, and that's why the artistic director left. It was too many seats to fill, not enough staff to fill it, not enough support infrastructurally, and she said, this ain't never gonna work. So she left. There was an opening. I was at the JCC looking to get something started as a researcher for the gallery, the Anlo Bronfman Gallery, that was doing a little exhibition on the 50th anniversary of the Hollywood Blacklist.
Oh, yeah.
So there I was researching, and then they suddenly said, hey, this guy, he's a writer, he's an educator, maybe he'll be silly enough to take on a theater $26,000 a year. That's the salary they offered me. I said, surely you can do better than that. Certainly they couldn't. There was a no negotiating posture. It was like trying to buy a new car from Saturn. You know, there was no haggling and no negotiating with the JCC.
And also, you weren't coming in there having, with all due respect, you hadn't been an artistic director anywhere else. Had you even directed much?
Never. And I was a playwright. And,
yeah.
And I did not train as a director. I had directed a lot of student work, but never a professional production. Nor was I going to start directing professional productions. What I did know how to do was read scripts. I had been a former literary director at Circle Repertory Company off-Broadway. I'd been a produced playwright in Washington, D.C., and in New York, and Chicago, and across the country, and published, and I knew how to nurture.
Now, let me ask you, though.
Importantly, Rabbi.
Yes?
I was a camp counselor.
Oh!
Don't forget the importance of Jewish summer camp and the American theater.
That's where so many of the Borschtfeld comics went, and but my question to you, though, is, okay, so you didn't come from the directing side, but how much time does an artistic director have to deal with budgets and fundraising?
Very much. You can you can quiz me on how much any particular show cost or made grossed of 129 productions that I did, and I can tell you the numbers. But what, you know, when artists dream, they dream of money. That's what Pablo Picasso said, and that's because we don't know anything, you know, about arithmetic, but we do know about income, and we do know about what, you know, the important numbers.
All right, well, you challenged me, so I will challenge you. What was the biggest box office, maybe not the biggest artistic hit or whatever, but the biggest box office thing that you did?
When we produced Chaim Potok's The Chosen at Arena Stage, we were invited in to be the first guest company of the brand new Arena Stage when they did the $100 million renovation, and they opened up the Fitch Ambler Theater, incidentally the same theater space where my play Born Guilty premiered in 1991, directed by founding visionary producer Zelda Fitch Ambler.
Oh, yeah.
2011, we produced Aaron Posner's adaptation of Chaim Potok's The Chosen, and we brought in $275,000 in single ticket sales.
Gewalt! Mazel tov on that.
And that doesn't even count subscription income, which was another $60,000 on top of it.
Now, having been an artistic director for about 16, 17 years at Theater J, could you sort of sense when, before you sold that first ticket, when a show would be a tough slog to sell and when, you know, it would be flying out the door? Did you have like a Christmas carol instinct?
Can I give you a tough slog?
Sure.
A play called The Prostate Dialogue. Now, you and I, Rabbi, we know from prostate.
Hey, Gewalt, do we ever.
I mean, how's yours been recently?
Oh, mine has been so bad, I had to visit a prostitute.
Okay.
Sorry, just kidding.
That's a good one. Now, you see, I committed to doing a play called The Prostate Dialogues as part of our locally grown community-supported art festival, done by a wonderful storyteller and performance artist named John Spellman.
Okay.
And they're doing a whole conversation about masculinity and what happens as a man's sense of himself changes as issues with prostate evolve. And it was a whole play about even prostate awareness and a conversation amongst men about being men. This play we were developing and we were going to produce on the set of Freud's Last Session by Marc St. Germain.
Okay.
The good news is, Rabbi.
Yes.
Freud's Last Session was the second highest grossing show in Theater J history.
Well, that rang in New York for a bunch of years. It was a very
popular
show.
Right, so we brought in $215,000. ticket sales on that show.
However, the
but
prostate...
on that set,
yeah,
also did John Spellman's The Prostate Dialogues, and over 16 performances, we made a grand total of $9,600.
Now, what, but you couldn't, I mean, you
think
the vagina monologues did so amazingly well. Is it because men just don't, what? What do you...
Okay, Rabbi, let me ask you, yeah, what is the difference between a vagina and a prostate?
Well, let's see. Things go into
about several billion dollars, I think, is what we...
There you go. That's a good answer. Good. I was...
I mean, you know, in fact, you would think with the erectile dysfunction industry selling at such a clip, a play like The Prostate Dialogues would be money in the bank. But it goes to show you can't count on anything in the American theater.
Yeah, the only thing that theater people know is that they don't know anything. That's an old line, too. And it doesn't matter how many years, ask any producer on Broadway if they're 100% sure about something. Nope, you never can tell. You never can. So let's get to what happened with you and Theatre J more recently, over, I guess, the past 2 years. Something began unraveling. Could you sense it?
Sure, but of course, Rabbi, I could sense it from the beginning because there was always an interesting structural tension between an enterprising and ambitious theater director and theater maker and the interests of a Jewish community center. We had many things in common and many things aligned, including the desire to put butts in the seats of this theater, a desire to bring in a new audience to celebrate urban Jewish culture. So you could see that we were interested in sophisticated fare. Oh, you know what, Rabbi? I got my parents calling me.
Oh.
Folks, could we keep it down a little? I've got a rabbi interviewing me. Oh, Rabbi, it's going to get loud in here.
If they're nice, I'll give them a blessing. Tell them that.
So anyway, so there were always balancing acts. I don't know if you have a Jewish community center out there in Schnippershnook where you are. Maybe you do, but you know, there's the ballet class wants the same space as the musical, wants the same space as the film festival, wants the same space as the annual benefit. You know, everybody's jockeying for prime real estate in the Jewish community center, and that also was happening at ours.
So, but I mean, with all due respect, every artistic director of a theater company, especially if they're renting, they don't have a building per se of their own, is going to be going through the same things. They're going to have to...
Of course, I'm being universal. You can identify with the normal tensions that come with being a theater director as part of a larger program.
But...
So that's one part of it. And then and of course, when you're interested in doing work that is cutting edge, you risk ruffling feathers, whether it's you're using language that can be offending. And of course, many theaters have tittered when they, experiencing the work of a contemporary playwright who uses the F-bomb.
I give up. I know. Ay-yi-yi.
And then you go even further and you say, let's start talking about issues and political matters that might offend certain members of the community. Now, for many, many years, Theatre J did programming on Israel that was very engaging and very cutting edge. In the year 2000, we did David Hare's play Via Dolorosa.
Well, Hare is one of those Englishmen who is always kind of... I think English still feel bad for letting Israel go, and they're always kind of pissed off and anti-Semitic about it.
Well, his journey in that play was from being very distant and aloof and disengaged with Israel, and then he goes there in 1998.
He also goes to Palestine, or they call Palestine.
Yeah. To Israel as part of... while Israel is celebrating its 50th anniversary, and he goes from being sort of aloof and detached to making relationships, getting to know people, interviewing people deeply, and becoming very, very connected and very, very torn by all the different kinds of testimonies he hears. He talks to left-wing Israelis, he talks to right-wing settlers, he talks to Palestinians in Gaza and in Ramallah and folks in Jerusalem, and by the end, his head has been through the spin cycle. As he keeps asking people, what is the way forward? What is the way forward? And who knew? We did this play during the teeth of the Second Intifada in the year 2000, and we staged a project called the Peace Cafe, where we brought Jews and American Muslims and Christians and peaceniks of all stripes together, and non-peaceniks, you know, just tribalists, if you will, people who were really concerned about Israel during that Second Intifada and all of the, you'll remember, the suicide bombings and the sense of siege that was happening.
Yeah.
Our theater opened its doors rather than closed them.
But that was 15...
Invited people in to experience the complexities of the drama and to create a conversation in the community about a way forward. And that was seen as extraordinarily constructive, healing, and important. And so we were encouraged to keep doing programs around Israel over the decade. And this Voices from a Changing Middle East Festival took root. Sorry, my father's trying to find a chair. Wally, come over here.
Come in, Wally. Come talk to us.
Wally's joining the conversation.
Very nice. Hello, Wally. Shalom.
Rabbi Saul says hello. I'm talking to the Stephen Colbert of Jewish Radio right here.
Well...
What do you think of that comparison, Rabbi?
I think that's a very, very kind... I am on the right-wing side, I have to admit. And also, I mispronounced what... Most people would pronounce my name Suleiman, but I say Solomon, sort of the way he does Colbert.
So anyways, but this festival, which saw us do, you know, 40 readings, workshops, and over a dozen main stage productions from and about Israel, that in 2007 saw us do probably our third full production of Israeli playwright Moti Lerner, his play Pangs of the Messiah, with eight other plays around it. And that was all part of, in conjunction with the Capital Fringe Festival as well. So, you know, we were creating a real energy at our Jewish Community Center, inviting in the whole city to participate, not just in a main stage production, but in all these workshops and readings as well, with peace cafes. And,
but all this was going on for several years. I mean, you mentioned Via Dolorosa in 2002.
When we were hip deep into it.
Yeah.
So you say, Rabbi, when did things change?
When did things change? That's what I say.
I'm going to say that. And things changed around 2009. And in 2009, you know, there was a change in Israel, too. This was right after Operation Cast Lead. The Israeli campaign into Gaza, a bad war, a big election in Israel, and a new government, and a new foreign minister. I don't know if your listeners know who Avigdor Lieberman is, but he was a strong-minded, and still is, a strong-minded minister in the cabinet, and he headed up the foreign ministry. They were very conscious of the images and the messaging that they wanted to have sent out into the diaspora about Israel, and a hope to change the conversation about Israel. There was a Jewish agency initiative called Brand Israel, and that was a way of focusing a conversation on the positive stories of Israel, on Startup Nation, on everything that was good, and to steer people away from the exhausting conversation of the conflict.
Okay.
So that initiative began to take hold, and there were groups, or one small group, in a suburb of Washington, D.C., that took upon itself to begin criticizing Theater J for its offerings. And that criticism, which was shrill, I felt, and frequently, if not always, inaccurate, as a because they never came to see the plays, but they heard about them. They heard about their success, and they suggested that they were giving Israel a black eye, and that they were anti-Zionist and anti-Israel. And of course, people who saw these productions of Israeli plays by Israeli playwrights,
right,
people who had fought for the state of Israel, who children were fighting. fighting for the state of Israel, people who were proud to be Zionists, but are also proud to be dissident voices within their country. And of course, we did plays that were not less dissident or differently dissident. We did plays by feminists who were upset with the, you know, the sort of male prerogatives and the religious the religious injunctions that were making it difficult for Israeli religious women to be fully respected, in plays like Hadar Gauron's Mikveh, or plays like Savion Liebrecht's Apples from the Desert. We were doing works that expressed a whole range of experiences within Israel.
But were the people who were dissenting against the theater and against your programming, was it specifically because about the Palestinian issue, or was it just in general bad language, too feminist? You're going to have the Tony Kushner play about the homosexual. I can't even know the whole title, but it's the title is longer than the play, I think. But
no. You know what? It was 14 words in the title, and that's still shorter than the play.
Okay.
3 hours and 20 minutes.
I'm joking, but you know what I'm saying? Was it specifically a Palestinian or Arab versus Israel?
I would think so. I think when we touched on that subject, that's when sensitivities were most aroused, and it's particularly because in trying to create a legitimate conversation between opposing narratives, which is to say an Israeli narrative and a Palestinian narrative, about what? About origin stories, about 1948, for example. And there were two plays that we touched on most famously. In 2011, we presented the Kamari Theater, the flagship theater of Israel. We paid a lot of money and worked very hard for over a year to bring the Kamari Theater of Tel Aviv to be in residence with us for 18 days. And they presented 17 performances of Return to Haifa, which was an adaptation by Israeli playwright Boaz Gaon of the Palestinian novella by Ghassan Kanafani called Return to Haifa. And Kanafani was an interesting figure. He's one of the most lauded man of letters in Palestinian culture.
Well, that doesn't take much, but okay, sorry.
What's that?
I said it doesn't take much. I'm kidding.
He was also a spokesperson for the PFLP, so he was a political activist as well. But as a learned man, and a man who, you might say, culturally was a Palestinian moderate, he recognized the humanity of the Israeli Jew living next to him. He wrote compellingly of the trauma of the Holocaust and its impact on Jewish immigrants. And so he created in Miriam and Ephraim two characters who come to Israel and who, with the formation of the state, approach the Jewish agency and get a house, an abandoned house, and in this house, they are told, is a child. It was discovered a child, a baby left behind in the Battle of Haifa. And they agree to raise this child. They discover, of course, that it's a Palestinian child who was left behind. And after 1967, the Six-Day War, the Palestinian family who had fled Haifa return with the opening of the borders, and they return to the house. And they meet Miriam, now a widow, the Holocaust survivor, and they want to find out about the house, but mostly they want to find out about the child that they were forced to leave behind. And they meet that child soon, who is now a 17-year-old in the Israeli Defense Force.
Wow.
A child they had named Khaldun, who now goes by the name of Dov. And so Dov, in his Israeli army fatigues, sees his birth parents, and he sees his nurturing mother, and of course he has to decide whose child is he, and where is he going to sleep for that evening. And so that is the melodrama, really, that Ghassan Kanafani wrote as a adapted for an Israeli version of the story. And that is what we presented on stage. And we presented it in Hebrew and in Arabic with English subtitles for 17 totally sold-out performances, an amazing series of panel discussions, both among Israelis, American Jews, Palestinians, Christians. We had very, very lively and constructive and meaningful conversations, and the audience stayed for all of it, and they were deeply, deeply touched by it. And there were no complaints during the show, during the performance, really. We only began to experience the real criticisms of it after the impact of this production had fully registered on the community. And that's when the group began to agitate and began to say how inappropriate it was that the Jewish Community Center had staged this work. And you might say that the arguments that began in 2011 that continued from year to year thereafter were all about whether a message like the one we were presenting, which was human lives are at stake, we have to figure out a way to coexist, and we have to negotiate with humanity and with understanding and with tolerance. And
I don't think that'll ever happen.
It may not ever happen, but artists have to have hope, and people have to hear about other people's versions so that they can have versions of history and personal experiences so they can be more aware of the situation of the world around them.
I just think, I can only play devil's advocate at this point, but I think for the past 2-3 years, media has been dumping on Israel in a way that they never did before. When the Gaza and what was going on there, and maybe it's just that members of the board and this fraction organization that you mentioned just said, look, of all places that we don't want criticizing Israel so much, would be the one Jewish theater that we have. I mean, that I can only think maybe that's what's really behind it, of saying this should be the one oasis where we don't just hear positive things, but we don't need to hear the Arabs bitching about Israel.
In fact, you might say, where is the one oasis where we can invite in, within a Jewish context, we can invite in our brothers and sisters from across the divide and hear stories and work on our problems together? I think I would argue that there are many oases where we can come and be Jews together and block out the outside world and not work on any healing discourse or go through any common experiences together. We've got lots of pockets where we can all be isolated and we can work on strengthening our resolve and self-esteem. But how many places have been successfully creating safe spaces to bring different communities together for important conversations? Tell me, Rabbi, how many places like that do we have?
Well, there's, I guess we can invite people to a deli. That would be all right. Maybe a nice trip to the zoo. We can sit around, have a nice box lunch, you know, with our Arab friends and enemies. Well, no, just the friendly Arabs, of course.
But the truth is that to bring people together for a constructive purpose and to experience stories that really focus, that aren't about a delicatessen and that aren't about a zoo, but that are really about our history, our shared history. And though that history may have different versions, we try to piece together a narrative that allows for different perspectives to coexist at the same time. You might say that's a kind of deli smorgasbord. You might say, how can we eat a little bit of this and a little bit of that and it all go into the same stomach?
Now, speaking of a little bit of this and a little bit of that, you identify yourself currently, now that you're no longer with Theater J, as the artistic director of something called, what, the New Mosaic? A mosaic is something that's all put together from different things. What is this?
It's new.
Okay, new, showing, but what is it?
Mushoin, it's something I'm just starting with friends and people. It will continue the work of the Voices from a Change of Middle East Festival in a new, beautiful theater across town, and we will tell stories of bridge building and bringing different communities together for reckonings and realizations about ways in which we are differently similar and similarly different. We'll tell important stories, comedies and musicals and straight plays that celebrate that fusion and that meeting place of different cultures.
Is that your own theater? I mean, is it going to be the new Mosaic Theater, or are you going to be renting the space?
We're renting a space from the Atlas Performing Arts Center. We're renting a 250-seat space that will look and feel somewhat similar to the Goldman Theater at the Washington, D.C. JCC. And hopefully, we'll partner with Theater J, as we'll partner with the African Continuum Theater Company, and we'll partner with Woolly Mammoth Theater, and we'll partner with Georgetown University, American University, and the University of Maryland. We like the idea of building partnerships and bringing lots of different stakeholders together to experience these dramas.
We've been chatting with Ari Roth, the new artistic director of the new Mosaic Theater. Do you have your first show set yet, the first idea of what your premiere production will be?
No, I just got fired a week ago, Rabbi. Give me a break.
Well, may I suggest a little show called Shalom Damn It.
Shalom Damn It, I've heard of that. But, you know, I heard that the radio guy is hard to work with. But I, you know, listen, radio personalities are difficult, but you're an angel. So I think you should talk to that other guy. But I'd do something by you any day.
Oh, well, it's my show. Then go, check. I'll send you this script. You can take a look.
Oh, I thought it was this night this guy Lefkowitz.
Oh, no, he's a jerk. No, he's terrible. He co-wrote the show with me, but I did most of the work.
I see.
He let me sit in his basement and use his lamp, basically.
I got the impression of, you know, one guy talking to himself, which was kind of weird, but good. I'm glad to consider that script as our inaugural production.
Oh, good. Okay, in fact, I will even tell you, as I will tell our listeners, that if you want to see an early version of the show, it's on YouTube. So you can actually see it performed by me. Not that I'm pressuring you, not that I won't call you tomorrow morning to say, did you watch it? But I will call you in 48 hours to ask, did you watch it?
Okay.
It's called Shalom Damn It with two M's, and it's brilliant, if I say so myself, and I do say so myself.
I think you are saying so yourself.
Yes, and I also say that it has been delightful talking with Ari Roth, who is the, as I said, the artistic director of the new Mosaic Theater. Can I ask you, last question for you, besides, I guess Death of a Salesman would be, but do you have a favorite play or musical of all time?
Well, Death of a Salesman is a great play, and I really do love it. I will say that my favorite production I ever saw was another mentor of mine, Lanford Wilson's play, Balm and Gilead, performed by the Steppenwolf Theater Company. John Malkovich directed in it, and
I think Tom Waits was in there, wasn't he, or something like that?
Tom Waits' music, you know, scored all around, and Bruce Springsteen, and Ricky Lee Jones. You know, it was a very 1981 production, and Laurie Metcalf was the star actress in it, and, you know, it was just one of the, it was a thrilling, thrilling experience for me. Gary Sinise was all over it, Jeff Perry, a lot of TV stars were in it. But they weren't then. Then they were just scruffy theater actors. I saw it in Chicago. I saw it in New York at Circle Rep, where I worked. And it conveyed the joy of ensemble acting and the whole fusion of complete sensory experience of music, setting, dialogue. It was thrilling.
And considering that your first artistic director job was in a 35-seat theater in a basement, it helped your dream, I guess, bigger.
Well, I never started at the 35-seat. I moved into the 200.
Oh, you were right into the big place already. Wow.
That's right.
So, final, I lied before. That wasn't my final question. My final question for...
The final question
for Ari Ruff, because also my friend Dave, whom I know you don't like, but I...
You know what? I want to talk to that guy Dave again. He really got on my nerves. Rabbi, I can talk to, but this Dave guy, he would do this weird thing where we would talk and then he'd hang up on me, and then we'd talk and he'd hang up on me, and I really got to be a little upset with him. But with you, there's no hanging up.
Well, that's what can I tell you? Dave is full of hang-ups. That's why he's on the radio. He's an uptight, hung-up kind of guy. But I'll put him on as soon as I'm off. As soon as we finish this.
Really, don't want to talk to that guy ever.
My goodness. Well, that's a shame because he's a very.
No, he employs. He's your employer or whatever it is. But
yeah, I have to say nice things about him.
You go out on your own. Actually, I think you could leave the schnook and start on your own, and it would be good for both of you.
Well, yeah, it would certainly be good for me, let me tell you that. But we've been friends for so long, I would feel guilty. Well, I'm Jewish, I feel guilty all the time anyway, so I guess it won't be that much worse. But my question is because Dave himself has, believe it or not, taught playwriting. So I wanted to ask you, Ari Roth, what was the main thing that you tried to impart in your playwriting students at the University of Michigan? What's something that you wanted to teach each and every one of them if you could?
I have a major dramatic question.
Ooh.
Your major dramatic question is finished. Your play is done. So that's I learned structure and I love structure and that's the University of Michigan way. That's the Kenneth Thorbrow, Arthur Miller way. I came from the school of the well-made play, and while you can look at great theater today and see lots and lots of innovation and experimentation, there's nothing like a well-made scene. And, you know, that's really why I love the work of Tony Kushner now, because as radical a playwright as he is, he knows from structure and he knows from writing a gorgeously composed scene. And so I really still appreciate the craftsmanship of the playwright. And of course, you know, I always tell my students, and I'm sure that dude Dave does as well, you spell playwright with a W-R-I-G-H-T, right like a shipwright, a wheelwright. These are craftsmen, and a playwright's a craftsman. And so you have to have respect for the craft.
That was beautifully, beautifully put. You are a wordwright, quite honestly. You know, that's what you are.
Say that to all the guests.
You're a phrase right. No, I don't. No, just the ones, either the ones like I really mean it or the ones that were cute that I want to sleep with. So that basically.
Bye.
And you would be in the former catalog.
I may be a producer of the Intelligent Homosexual's Guide to Capitalism and Socialism, but this is strictly a phone relationship.
No, absolutely. Absolutely. I'm even putting away my text right now. So, it has been once more a joy. And by the way, does your new theater company have a website yet?
It does, but I can't give you the URL until Monday. So call when Dave calls to bug me.
That's right.
Did you see it? I'll give you the URL. But you can bet it's mosaictheater.org. So
it will most likely be Mosaic Theater. Theater with an R-E or an E-R?
E-R. E-R.
E-R. Even though you are R-E. Get it? Little, okay. Anywho, mosaictheater.org, a joy and a pleasure, and happy holidays, by the way. Happy New Year to
happy
you.
Happy Erev Christmas. I mean, this is going to happen at a later date, but readers should know, and listeners should know, this was recorded on Erev Christmas, which is significant.
I guess. And well, it's more significant that we're not talking to this man on Shabbos, oi, 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 even though he's a... What was his, a Reconstructodox? What was your thing?
That's right. I said Reconservodox. I went to a Reformed summer camp, an Orthodox day school, and a conservative shul, and my parents are labor Zionists, so sue me.
Sue me? So labor Zionists. So that's a little left-wing-ish. I get it.
It's left-wing. It is. We're left-wing and proud of it.
Or as I like to say, left-fliggle. That's the way we used to put it, where fliggle is a wing. Anyway,
I think the time has come, Rabbi.
Yes, it certainly has. Anyway, it's come and gone. But it's been fun talking to you, and we really thank you, and certainly wish you much success doing more theater, more good things in your new theater, and what else can I say? Happy New Year, Ari Roth.
All righty. Bye-bye.
Shalom to you.